Happy Thursday, Nod Pod. It's May. It's so nice outside again. Who else is so stoked about that? Every time I come home from the studio and I walk Tank, it's so nice that it's warm out. For here, anyways. I guess I don't know if it's warm everywhere, but it's warm here and I'm able to just like walk around in flip-flops. And it reminds me, this is literally the life I always wanted. I always just wanted to teach spin and have a pug and like live in a nice place and walk my little pug in the warm weather. And I have it. And it's those moments that still flood me with gratitude. And I try to catch them when I notice them. Welcome back to the show. If you have ever wondered how you will possibly get back on track financially and maybe got sober in your 30s, 40s, we don't have a 401k, what are we gonna do? Then you will love today's episode. I interviewed my friend, Kevin, another buddy of mine from my 12-step home group meeting who knocked it out of the park. His story is fun and entertaining. It's also very recovery heavy. He is very involved in service and he credits that with the success of his recovery. I learned from him weekly. In fact, there was a guy when I first started going to HA, his name was Joe, and I swore I wasn't going to take another newcomer token. I just couldn't do it. You know what I mean? I could not bring myself to stand up even one more fucking time and walk up to that room and take a new token. I just wasn't going to do it anymore. And I hadn't been for like a while as I would come in and out. And I went to my first HA meeting and my buddy Joe stood up, who I didn't know yet, right? It's the first time I laid eyes on him. And he started to just do the thing, you know, anybody with under 30 days. And he paused for a moment and looked at the newcomer token, and he had like 5 years at this point, and said, you know, it's so hard for a junkie to get even one day. I want you to honor that one day. Come up, get a token from me, please. And I don't know why I did. I stood up and I got a token, and I'm really glad that I did, because was that the first newcomer token that I took? Nope. Was it the last? Yeah, so far. And I have it on a keychain, and I'm glad that I stood up and I did honor that struggle, because he was right. Even one day is so difficult, you know? And he has since moved on from that meeting. And I always thought, man, who am I going to continue to learn these like philosophical lessons from around recovery? And my friend Kevin has totally become that guy. Every time he shares, I learn something so extra about the principles of recovery or whatever he's sharing on. And that's what we get in meetings or in some sort of fellowship recovery situation, whether it be your church or the group of people you work out with or your book club, you know, whatever, the group of people that you can learn from, be motivated by, be inspired by, and in turn, motivate them, inspire them, teach them. Like, that's the good stuff, you know? So, okay, you guys, I'm so excited. We got an NDPE. So for my long-term listeners, y'all know an NDPE is a near-death poop experience. And that is what happens when an opiate addict does not poo for a long time. And you get to the point where you could get murdered by your own poo when you attempt to pass that thing. And we have episodes where Nate and I have shared our own personal NDPEs. And I asked for people to send them in and we got one. Also, I tell you guys what, if I get 3 more NDPEs, they can be anonymous. Like, I'm going to keep this guy as anonymous. I wrote him back and said, can I use your name? And I didn't hear from him, so I'm not going to. They can be anonymous. If I get 3 NDPEs, we will bring Narcan Nate back to the in-person studio, which I want to show him anyways. We'll check in with him, see how he's doing, and we'll go over our Nodpod NDPEs together. What do you say? So 3 NDPEs. Let's get him going. So title, my NDPE. Oh, chasingheroin@gmail.com. Or you could DM me on Instagram. Hey, y'all. First of all, I just want to say I love the show and I appreciate what y'all are doing. I was starting to slack on my program when I hit the year mark and I found the show. It's reminded me to never forget where I came from and that my sobriety always comes first, because I can lose all the things I've gained way quicker than it took me to get them. I'm at 17 months now and still going strong. So, at one point in my addiction, I was on 80 milligrams of methadone while shooting fentanyl and hadn't shit in over 3 weeks and started to get scared because I had tried everything. I went to the ER and they did an ultrasound, LOL, and saw that I had a huge blockage. They proceeded to bring a specialist in who told me, quote, this is going to suck. I'm so sorry. He had me lay on my side while he stuck his fingers up my ass to break it up and pull it out. It was the worst pain I'd ever been in, and that was just the start. They then put a huge enema in me, and my stomach cramped up so bad that they were trying to get me to sit still, but I couldn't. I finally sat down on the bedpan and passed out. Like, I legit don't remember anything till I woke up and saw what had come out of me! Exclamation point. The size of this thing was insane. I went to detox that week, LOL, but didn't get it that time. Like I said, I've almost got a year and a half now, and this is the best my life has ever been. Thank you guys for the podcast. Love y'all. We love you too. Thank you so much for sharing your NDPE. I would love to hear any other NDPEs that any of you guys have. This is a thing, man. It happened. And if you want to hear mine and Nate's, go back and listen to it. I think it was the first episode back of season 4, maybe. And it's pretty funny. I think you guys are going to dig it. So NDPEs, send them my way. Comments. Oh, we have so many reviews too. Okay, guys, so check it out. I have 196 Spotify reviews. I want 200. Spotify's very easy. No names, no written reviews, just a star. You do have to be following the show, but you should be following the show anyways if you listen. So if you haven't actually hit like the follow or whatever it says, please do that. And then I want 4 more. I would love to get 200. We're at 150 iTunes. I'd love to get that sucker up to 200 because I was Googling the show and in some of the metrics charts where they evaluate where your show falls, they add up all your reviews and just give the number. And so that's a definitely a helpful thing to kind of keep propelling the show forward. So if you have not yet done a review, please do so. I would love that. And DMing me comments on the episode is great too, because I can post them. And, you know, especially when it's a person from a meeting and not like an influencer or an author or someone who's used to being in the public, so to speak, it's so nice for them to see the positive feedback. Cause you know, you pour your heart out in here and you walk away and you think, man, like, how did I do? I don't know if I did that well. You guys know how it is. We're all addicts. We're second guessing everything. And when I get to tag them on the DMs that say, Vegas was amazing, I loved what he said, or I love that Julia spoke about ADHD and depression and sobriety, like they get to see it and see that they matter and their voice and their message and their time mattered. So the DMs on the episodes are amazing. Thank you guys so much. We'll check in next week and please let me know what you think of Kevin's episode. Bye. Cool, man. Hi, Kev.
Hi, Janine.
I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for inviting me.
I just posted on my story. I get to interview somebody today that I've wanted to interview for a long time because I've wanted to interview you for a really long time.
Thank you.
And so I don't know. And the reason I want to interview you is, were you ever at HA when Joe Napier was kind of running things?
No.
Okay. You've heard of him though?
Actually, no.
Okay. So Joe was kind of like you of that time. He made HA kind of what it is, right? Like he ran things when we were at the Friday Night Step House. But more than that, he was brilliantly motivating. And you are also, when you share, I learn things from you literally every single time. And that's how I felt with Joe. Joe changed my life. And HA was really lacking that kind of voice. And I'm so grateful that you kept it going during COVID. We'll get to all that stuff. But just the way that you share, though I don't know the details of your story, I love the stuff that you share in recovery. And I'm so fucking grateful that you kept HA going during COVID. Like, I don't know how you found the patience to do that. Just so you guys know what I'm talking about. Kevin, when all the meetings were closed, would bring outdoor candles and Tupperwares of books and set up at parks and talk to the cops and tell them, trust me, you'd rather us be here than, I can't do a New York accent. You'd rather us be here than robbing houses. Say it the way you would say it.
Hey, if we weren't in a meeting, we had 50, 60 people and that would have been a lot of paperwork.
Right, exactly.
50, 60 junkies running the street. That
exactly.
would have been a lot of paperwork.
Exactly. And I'm just so glad that you kept it there. But let's talk about how you got to HA. So I know you're from New York.
I'm from Queens, New York.
Okay. So your family, what it was like growing up, where you grew up, and what your family structure was like.
I really don't talk about this much, but I guess okay. This is the perfect venue for it. I mean, I grew up in Queens. I have an older brother, you know, a father who had a business and a mother. I came from a great family, a lot like you. A lot of people, you hear it in these rooms, they came up really rough.
Yeah.
And the long and short of it is that's not my story.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like the opposite of it where, you know, I've had every advantage in life and still somehow managed to find myself seeking these deeper and deeper bottoms. And, you know, my mother passed away when I was 19, which was really sudden. She went in like 2 weeks. And I was more like my mother's kid. It was always, I came from a great family, but there was some stuff going on between my mother and my father. And it was always kind of like, Michael's your son and Kevin's my son.
Oh, interesting.
Type of thing.
So, but you have the same parents. Both of each other's.
And yeah, they lived in the same house most of the time. You know, my father was still really involved in my life. Always, his thing was getting me to work. And, you know, he would raise me at his office, at his shop and stuff like that. Because that's okay. Where he had his time with us. And
okay.
You know, that's where he was. He's like us. He worked a lot. You know what I mean? And looking back as a kid, like, oh, you know, my dad's not around. But as an adult, I see it. Like, you know what I mean? You're not around because you were doing what you needed to
totally.
Do.
Totally. And I know family. What you mean, too. You can have a great family structure in terms of what you and I hear a lot in the rooms from other kids. But there's always still some weird dynamic. I was my dad's kid and my brother was my mom's kid. Like, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So what did your dad do? What kind of shop did he own?
So he did a lot with tires and,
like auto stuff.
Trucks. He was pretty big. He had like sanitation contracts. He was one of the bigger, or maybe top two or three in New York. So he had a fairly successful business.
Okay.
So I didn't grow poor either.
Right. Okay. Was he connected? Can you say?
My father had a probably really checkered past because he came from nothing.
Okay.
And there were some people he may or may not have done business with.
But okay.
Once he had kids, everything kind of changed for him.
Okay.
So he never raised me to he always raised me, hey, respect these people, be nice to these people, don't get involved with these people.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It just was always very clear that, you know, this only ends one of two ways. You know what I mean? So,
and I'm only asking that, I think, because I'm watching The Sopranos right now. I'm rewatching The Sopranos right now. And Meadow says, he's in this, he's in that. His businesses may brush up against some organized crime, but blah, 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 blah. And so that's the only reason to ask.
Is this when she showed AJ online?
And yes.
The fucking world was
yes,
shocked?
Exactly. Yeah. But I would think that would be so cool. But anyways, so he's doing auto stuff, some waste management contracts. What did your mother do?
My mother came from nothing. She stayed home and she raised us.
Okay.
But she was also, she was a very driven person as well. Not driven, money didn't make my mother happy. My mother had really good values and she's very, very good with money. I get that from my mother more than my father's relationship with money is a little different. When I was like in third grade, she went back to work. She didn't have to. She just did. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? And she didn't have an opportunity to go to college because they came from like a really, really, my grandfather was a produce. Like he worked at a fruit stand, like back in New York. Like they had like nothing. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He didn't own it.
Yeah.
He worked there till like 90.
Yeah.
She didn't have an opportunity to go to college. I can only afford to send one. And that was my uncle. So when she went back to work at Queens College, she went back, she took classes. She actually graduated with a 4.0.
Like
my mother did some phenomenal, while having two kids and, you know, some personal stuff in my mother's life that looking back as an adult must have been really hard for her to handle, but she never bled on us. She just kind of always carried her load.
Isn't that wild to think that, because you and I have spoken about this, we both never wanted kids. I know, but you know, not everybody feels that way. You know, you and I do, but a lot of people don't agree with us. But can you imagine? I'm fucking tired all the time. I'm probably going to take a nap when you leave, bro. Can you imagine if you also had kids and you had to like work and do things? My mom, same way. Well, and both my parents, like they got so much done while having kids. Or I look at even some of the people we know around us that have children and get stuff done. I don't know how, man.
If I would have had kids in my 20s, it might have been different. That's what everybody was doing. And then I probably would have had a lot more energy. The meth kind of would have made it weird for everybody, which thank God I didn't. And also the girls I was dating back then, like, thank God I didn't come in any of those chicks because what would happen is I would be sending him a check now.
Right.
And she'd be with some other douchebag.
For sure.
I'd be paying both their rent and I still wouldn't see my kids.
For sure.
And that's like literally what happened with this girl. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so out of all the stupid decisions I made, I always pulled out.
Of all the stupid things I did, I didn't have a kid.
Right.
And I remember talking to my mom about that once and I was like, well, what would you have done if I did have a kid? And she said, well, I mean, I would have raised it, obviously. When it wanted to get into the system, I would have taken the child for you if I had to, but you know, I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah, I it's just, thank God now sober, we could see how our lives affect other people's lives and everything else. And,
right.
You know, but yeah, you know what? It would have made for a great lead at HA.
I know. Like, those are the best ones when you get your kids back.
I did. I fuck. I this kid's life up just so she could carry a message.
Yeah, but I did her hair tonight for prom. That was the literal last night.
Yeah.
I also had not heard Carmina's story before.
Carmina's good.
I'm going to ask her if she'll do the show, actually. I texted her last night. I know she's like really tight on the tradition, so I'm going to reach out to her and be like, look, it's not anonymous, but I would love for you to do the show. I'm going to see if she wants to, because that was really good lead.
Well, so if she's just telling her story, she's not breaking any traditions.
Right. And you can just say 12-step. You don't have to say, I say H-A-A-A, whatever. You don't have to. You can just say 12-step, and that actually falls under the, you know, the traditions.
So an interesting thing with the traditions, and I'm not knocking them, they are essential, but when Bill W. wrote those traditions, it's because he literally broke every single fucking one of them.
Oh, really?
On the way. Like, Bill W., like, he...
I didn't know that.
He
was a little scandalous, though, right?
He was, yeah, dude. He used to sleep around.
Yeah, he cheated on his wife, right?
Pick up newcomers.
Sober?
Yeah, dude, he was... But, you know, when they talk about, you know, no outside money, like, that's what Bill W. did. He tried to sell stock in the Big Book.
Really?
To raise money. He tried to sell stock in AA. To raise money for the Big Book, and you know, he solicited the Rockefellers, and some of you tradition nuts don't lose your mind right now. But
none of my people are tradition nuts. Right, actually, cool. That's not true. A few of them are. My friend Rachel is.
Well,
she'll know.
You can't discount the message from the man just because he was a man.
Yes, agree.
You know,
agreed.
And he did. He carries a powerful message, and you know, God knows where any of us would really be without somebody bearing that load.
100%.
And putting all this together. But, you know, so refuge recovery, I've done a lot of refuge recovery. You know, I started a couple of refuge meetings too. That's a Buddhist inspired path to recovery. And it's the guy that started it, Noah Levine, he's up in LA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's a regular guy. You can go talk to him and this and that. But he had some stuff come out where, you know, he was, you know, something with females. This is during the Me Too movement. I don't know if it's true or not, but that doesn't discount from his message and
exactly.
his literature and everything else.
But that's how I feel about the program as a whole. This is something Nate and I used to fight about. One asshole doesn't make the whole program. It's like, you know, kids play Little League, and where I'm from in Georgia, Little League is a very, very, very big deal. It's very competitive. A couple of the dads that are coaches are assholes,
right.
And they're going to use a weighted bat, and they're not going to play all the kids every inning like they're supposed to. Does that mean you shouldn't put your kid in Little League? Nope. It means that one guy is an asshole, but the group values and what you learn from participating in Little League are incredibly beneficial.
Right, especially for kids that are in that stage of like kind of building their values and learning a work ethic and learning teamwork.
And you would never say Little League is f***ed because one guy cheated. And same thing in 12-step, I feel like, but I also think sometimes, I want to be careful here, but I think sometimes people, in, like in Nate's case, I've said this directly to him, Nate just didn't want to go anymore.
That's the thing. If you're looking for a fucking excuse, there's a million excuses. You'll find one.
You'll find one.
You don't have to look too hard. If you're looking for a message, there's a powerful message.
Right.
You'll find one too.
Right.
You don't have to look too hard.
Totally.
So with the Noah guy, they, you know, with Refuge, they actually separated. And like part of his, you know, group that was holding Refuge together was doing a different sect. And they were calling us. I think I had like two meetings live at the time. And they're like, hey, we want to switch over to this. We want you to be part of, I don't want to put the name out there. I want you to be part of this. And it's like, hey, we've been doing this for years. It works.
Oh, they were bagging on Noah because of the
meetings?
They were
trying to take all the refuge meetings and turn them into something else. And they were, I think there might have even been a lawsuit or something like that, whatever. But hey, we've been doing this for years. It works.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
also, like you said, pulling the man, how did you say it? The message from the man, just because he was a man doesn't mean the message is invaluable. People are not infallible.
I'm not fucking perfect.
Me neither.
Even when I sponsor people, hey, I could take you through the steps. I could take you through the works. I can't tell you I apply these every day of my fucking life. And honestly, I wouldn't be able to take a message from somebody that thought they were fucking perfect.
Me neither.
You know what I mean? I hate people at the meetings that share I'm holier than now.
Right.
But like, I don't want to hear, and then go home and beat your wife.
Right.
Like, I don't want to hear that.
Well, and that's why some people, I think, get turned off by the meeting, because there are some people that can come across a little bit hypocritically. But again, you got to look past that stuff.
Well, we're addicts, so we see through bullshit.
Yeah.
Like really, like that's one of our superpowers.
Yeah.
And when I used to work in recovery, I'd tell my clients all the time, I'm a fucking superhero. I see through bullshit like a mile away, dude. Don't even try it. Like, you know what I mean? But with the refuge thing.
Oh, yeah. So what did you say? No, I'm not taking your new stuff.
We're not doing it. A, they didn't have literature out.
Okay.
B, this is really fucking working. You know what I mean? But after COVID, we started another refuge meeting and it was huge. It was like 120, 130 people. And Noah actually called me. And he's like, hey, what's up, man? Kevin, I heard you do a lot. And I want to come down. I want to lead your meeting. Do you mind if I do that? You know what I mean? And he came down and he led the meeting. And when you see him, you're no longer looking at an author or a book. He's just a regular fucking dude.
Yeah.
He pulls up on his motorcycle. He talks like a regular dude. He is a regular dude. Like, you know what I mean? And the message is fucking powerful too.
Yeah.
Like, one of the reasons I kind of appreciate the fact that Noah is still around and involved is that people can go see him and can go talk to him. Whereas Bill W., like, you know, that's, we've idolized him.
It's all mythology.
We've made it some mythical figure. Yeah. When, like, you know, in all reality, Bill W. probably shared at meetings. Hey, I'm having a fucked up day, dude.
Totally.
Like, you know what I mean? Or this and that. And so.
So I totally digressed and took you off course, but I want to back up a little. So do you mind if I ask how your mother passed away when you were 19?
She didn't feel well for a little while, and she was putting off going to the doctor till, you know, after a wedding or something like that. And she went to the doctor, and she, they said they found cancer. And my mother was a fucking G. You know, she held it together like a fucking G. And, you know, we found cancer here, we found cancer there, we found cancer every fucking where.
Okay.
They started treating it aggressively, and within like 2 weeks, she was gone. So it just happened really, really quick, which sometimes it does. In hindsight, you know, how that affected my life, we could talk about that. But in hindsight, I think it's the best way to go.
Right.
You're not
I could see that.
You're not lingering three, totally. 4 or 5 years.
Absolutely.
You know, when we were discussing me possibly having cancer a few weeks ago, I was like, hey, dude, like, I'll handle this. I don't even feel like getting high.
Yeah.
But if it's stage 3 or 4, I don't plan on dying with dignity. And
so Kevin and I were talking about that. So I've actually never talked about this on the show, but I had 3 super, not scares. I actually had cancerous cells in my body when I had, you know, 18 months, I discovered all of them. And I thought the same thing. They were all cut out, but I thought the same thing. I'm probably not going to do this with dignity. I might just fucking use. Right. And when Kevin and I were speaking about this, and Kevin is okay as well, thankfully, he said the same thing, which I thought was fucking hilarious. But because I do want to talk about how your mom, how that affected you. Were you already using, how did you do in school when you were a kid? Did you do well academically? And when was the first time you got high?
So I actually did pretty well in school. It was always if he applied himself a little bit more, but I was able to pull in like B's without trying. You know, if I really would have applied myself now, like I applied myself to life now, it'd be totally different. But it was just a progression. As a matter of fact, I was, you know, I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood, and you know, we had our people and everything else. And I used to beat the shit out of kids that would drink or smoke.
Really?
Stuff like that. Yeah, I loved fighting when I was a kid. Dude.
Really?
I loved the rep, dude. I loved it.
You would fight?
Oh, yeah, all the time, man. Looking at my
stuff. Actually, I can kind of see that. Now it seems so distant, but I can kind of see that.
I think that.
Where did that come from, do you think?
I watched too many gangster movies.
Okay.
Plus the neighborhood I grew up in. But here's one of the things, like, I got addicted to it. So I loved going out fighting on weekends. And then we'd go to school on Monday, and everybody in high school would be talking about the fights.
Okay.
I had no problem wearing a black eye with pride and stuff like that. But here's the other thing is a lot of fear in my life now, like in general, there's fear in all of our lives. And I think when people saw me fighting, they didn't realize how scared I really was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, you know, so I used to beat the shit out of kids that used to do this stuff, just kind of keeping the neighborhood clean or whatever. And then, you know, one day I just went home, and everybody was kind of drinking in high school at this time. And there was alcohol in my closet. And I just said, you know, I'm going to drink. And I knew nothing about drinking, dude.
Okay.
So I just popped a bottle of Amaretto. I still can taste that.
I just drank it?
Yeah. Well, it's just old school Guidos. That's what we had in the house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's hilarious. How old were you?
I think 15.
And this is the first time you drank?
Yeah, it was a little later than some.
Me too. No, I was 15 too when I drank for the first time. I was later too.
Yeah, and I drank myself into complete alcohol poisoning that night.
Really?
And then
did you get caught? What happened?
I was on the floor in my shower, like puking and shitting myself, everything, dude. My brother comes in. I think my parents were away that weekend or something. And my brother comes in. Look what you did.
Is he older than you or younger than you?
He's older than me.
He's older than you. Okay. So did you get caught by your parents or just him?
Just him. Then it started progressing every weekend and pot and stuff like that.
Okay.
And my mother kind of knew. They didn't really say anything. I don't think they really, really knew. Honestly, I don't know how the fuck I hit it so well, but it wasn't really a conversation that was like, Kevin's got a problem. It was high school, dude. Everybody expects you to grow out of it.
Totally. But
my father thought expect me to grow out of it when I was 25.
Like, yeah.
Like, dude, by this time I'm full blown.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? But they don't know. They're not addicts. They're not alcoholics. They don't know. Some people do grow out of it. A lot of people grow out of it.
Right.
That just wasn't my story. But New York nightlife and club scenes. And
okay.
Shit
so
like that.
You graduate high school.
Oh, no. I was in high school, 15, 16 years old. I started getting really involved in nightlife in Manhattan.
Oh, before you finished school.
Yeah, I was a baby. I was in the clubs every weekend.
How did you get into clubs at that time?
New York, fake IDs, and, you know, it's just a different world. Way different than San Diego.
Okay.
Maybe LA might have a little bit of it, but even LA shuts down.
LA shuts down at like 2.
Yeah, dude, yeah. Like we...
Earlier.
Like in my 20s, we didn't even...
Last call was 4 a.m. on the East Coast.
But we didn't even go to the club till 5 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
We would go to the after hours clubs. We would go at like 5 a.m.
How did you get, if you remember, a fake ID? If you remember even
my
one
brothers,
of them?
My brothers.
Okay. It would just be one of their friends that you kind of look like.
Yeah, well, I would either take my brother's like later when he was finally 21, but I would get something. We'd go to Canal Street. And then back in, dude, this was, you know, I'm 43 years old, dude. This is 26, 27.
They weren't sophisticated.
No, it was just like a laminated card.
Right.
Like, that's it. There weren't any holograms on it or anything like that. Like, it was a laminated card. You gave somebody $8 and they printed
totally.
It for you. And plus, these guys, they're making money, dude. They weren't really checking that hard.
Right. How would you get to the city? So you're in Queens. I don't know anything about New York. You're in Queens. Manhattan is across water from Queens, correct? Or Queens is in Manhattan?
Is it a bridge or a tunnel into
There's
Manhattan?
A bridge.
It's not far. It's 20 minutes, 15
So you
minutes.
Could just take a cab to like a club?
No, I wouldn't take a cab. We find each other. So I'd find other people that were into the same shit as me.
And you'd drive.
We'd get a ride. We always found our way around.
Okay.
It's just same like when you're getting high. Dude, I did ketamine for years and nobody does fucking ketamine.
No one does ketamine.
But I found people that did ketamine
every
fucking day. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we find people that are into the same shit.
So you go to clubs, you're drinking, you're smoking a little weed. Did you start like doing coke or anything?
No, the clubs, that's when it escalated because that's when it was ecstasy.
Oh.
And then ketamine and then into cocaine and, you know, stuff like that. Really, you know, I was pretty off with just that stuff. But actually at that time I was able to limit, because it was ecstasy, I can limit it to the weekends.
Right.
But once the cocaine and the ketamine came in, then it started being a daily practice.
Were you working? How did you pay for things?
I used to work for my father. So it was very, very enabled. And when I was young, I did pretty good at selling and stuff because...
Oh, like baseball cards and shit?
No, selling the pills and the shit.
Not young, when you were like a teenager.
Yeah, I did pretty good at like selling that stuff and getting around. As my addiction progressed, like, you know, if it's in my pocket, it's in my stomach.
Right, yeah.
Or up my nose.
So do you keep going to school? You ended up graduating, right?
So I graduated high school.
We're both 98, right? Class 98?
Yeah.
I thought you were so much younger than me. I had no idea you were 43. I thought you were in your 30s.
I feel it, and I definitely feel it now.
Yeah. So class of 98, both of us. Did you go to school? Did you go to college?
I went to high school, but I was smoking pot every day before school, so I wasn't really there. And as a matter of fact...
What college did you go to?
I didn't go to college.
Oh.
So my mother died when I was 19, and I just started college. Once my mother died, that's when shit really like kind of...
You get into what was like a community college the first few semesters?
Yeah, I did a community college for a little bit, but I didn't take anything seriously.
Okay.
You know, my father had the business and he always kind of said like this, you know, this will be your guys. Like,
okay.
I had a family with a little bit of money and a lot of guilt after my mother died. As an addict, I used that to my advantage.
Okay.
My father begged for me to go. My mother on her deathbed, that was like her wish.
That was for you to finish school?
For me to finish school. She didn't go to school until she was in her 40s.
Right.
And, you know, she didn't have the opportunity. And she still graduated with a 4.0.
Yeah.
So she was really big on that.
And you were living at home still?
So when my mother died, my father had another residence, even when my mother and father were together. But when my mother died, my father never came back home. So it was just me and
my... So you just lived there alone?
It was just me and my brother. And he worked. He had a really good work ethic. Always busted his ass.
Your brother?
Yeah.
I want to call him Mikey. Did he go by Mikey? He had to have gone by Mikey. Michael.
It's Mike.
Okay.
Mikey, when he was like 12 with some girls and being, I don't know, whatever.
Okay.
But he was into kind of the same stuff on the weekends. He's a weekend warrior.
Okay.
But not like me that would do it, you know.
During the week.
Yeah.
So he's living somewhere else and he never comes back. So does that mean you get to live alone?
He didn't. Yeah. So we
not like he abandoned you. He just never moved back into the home.
He didn't have to because he had us at the shop. So he saw us every day.
Okay. But you are now living in your own place.
Yeah.
At 19.
And my place was like after the club, everybody comes over. That's just a place that's just where everybody was.
Did you have to pay the mortgage or anything?
No. I don't pay fucking shit, dude.
Okay.
I've kind of shit the bed on that opportunity there, dude.
So you're living there. kind of working at your dad's shop, not really, kind of going to school, not really. And then how do things, is Mike living there too with you, your brother?
My brother's there. Okay. Things just escalated. The cocaine kind of made it really weird and the progression got worse.
Okay.
And everybody thought I would grow out of it and, you know, started catching a lot of court cases, as we do.
What type of stuff did you get? Like, what was your first arrest? What happened?
A lot of assaults and violent stuff. A lot of possessions, like every fucking day. Oddly enough, no DUIs in New York, which was weird because I was fucked up every single day. No burglaries or anything like that. But I was always in some shit. So when I went back to New York to get my records, I think it was like 18. And that was from, I guess, I started getting... I didn't get locked up until after my mother was gone. I don't know, 19 to maybe 33 or 34.
Okay.
Something like that.
Did you ever actually do any jail time?
No, because my father had a little bit of money and a lot of guilt.
Yeah.
I would show up to the courthouse with the councilman would be my fucking lawyer. Like, right. You know what I mean? Initially. Plus, they weren't really big charges. So a lot of times they'd take two or three and they'd roll it into one.
That's what would happen to me too. Yeah. I got arrested a lot and never did more than 3 days.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Exactly. In and out. And then they'd put me like to like drug court or something like that. And it's like, hey.
Oh, did you actually do drug court?
In New York, it was a little different. But
okay.
It's like, hey, dude, all you got to do is stay clean. Like, okay.
So it wasn't like the daily groups and the go see the judge once a week. Because out here, it's a bitch.
No, it wasn't.
And quite successful. It but it's a big deal.
I'd have to see like a, you know, quote unquote PO or drug court officer once a week, and they would test me once a week.
Okay.
And that lasted for all of about 2 weeks before I couldn't like show up clean.
Okay.
They put me in my first treatment facility, like a state funded, like Phoenix House type place.
Okay. How old were you when you went there?
25.
Okay.
25.
Did they introduce you to 12 step at that time? Do you remember?
I got more, and I've been through quite a few programs. I got more out of that than probably any other program.
Really?
And not because of 12 steps, because they couldn't let you leave the house. It was prison, dude. Like everybody there was just trying to beat a fucking bid.
Okay.
120 people, you know, with four to eight people per room, but the rooms are about the size of this. There was just me and like two or three other white guys. Everybody just fucking crackheads right off the street. Like, you know what I mean? I remember my father coming and I was like, dude, you got to get me out of here. I'm not like these fucking people, dude. You got to get me out of here. And he's like, you're just like fucking people.
That's what my dad said to me too.
He's like, this is, you are more like these people than like us, dude.
That's how I used to feel too. Cause I was in similar treatments, as you know, similar treatment centers.
Yeah.
And I would feel the same way. You know, I was at Choices and whatever. And I was like, I'm not like you guys. And I'm like, in a lot of ways I was fucking worse. Cause I thought I wasn't like them.
Right.
They at least accept it. I thought I was not better. I wouldn't ever say better, but certainly different. I thought I didn't have to do all the same things because I had gone to college, sort of, though I didn't graduate, blah, blah, blah. So what about the Phoenix House, when you look back, or Phoenix House adjacent, did you learn there? Like, when you say you learned more there than anywhere else?
That place, introduce you to 12 steps a little bit. They'd have H&I come in. Couldn't go out to go to meetings because it was a lockdown facility. But it taught me how to be a fucking man.
Okay.
Told me, stop fucking whining, pull up your fucking pants, yeah. go do your shit, make your bed, wake up at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Just structure. Addicts, we need structure. I thrive under structure.
Me too.
You know what I mean? And thank God for structure. And but it taught me how to deal with that and just, you know, plus I wanted to get out of there. I worked hard and I did want to stay sober.
Oh, you did?
I did. You okay. know, dude, I was fucked. I remember being in 25 in treatment. It was like probably like 24 going on 25. It was like my birthday. And saying, I'm too old for this shit. I'm too old. And everybody would just laugh. It's like, you're a baby, dude. You're a baby. No, I'm too old for this shit. I need to grow up. Fast forward, I didn't get sober till I was 37.
Right.
Which is better than 57.
Yeah. So how long did you end up staying at that facility?
10 months. I actually.
Damn, that's a long time.
I got out. They didn't want to let me go because I was so good.
Okay.
They actually tried to keep me there, but it was supposed to be a year. But if you do really good, you get out at like 9 months.
Okay.
And they,
did you work while you were there?
So I kind of like was like there. As far as clients go, I was almost like staff. They were going to pay me because I did bust my ass. And, and find out I was just like those people. You know what I mean? You know, I didn't feel out of place at all being like the only white kid there or stuff like that. That's probably another time where I really stopped judging people by their skin.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Oh, do you feel like you used to before
Not
that?
Not so much, but hey, we're different. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
And there, it's like, we're not different. As a matter of fact, those actually became the people that looked out for me. It wasn't jail, like looked out for me. Like I didn't have suck dick or anything. But they just kind of looked out for me. And because I had, I always had a head on my shoulders.
Yeah.
Just, what was when, when it wasn't in the fucking clouds, you know, it was on my shoulders.
So when you went in there, was your main drug of choice alcohol, cocaine, ketamine, it sounds like?
So when I going in there, it was cocaine at that time, you know, and then like I wanted to be sober. It was one of those things I would do 95% of it and I wouldn't do the other 5%.
What do you think was the 5% you didn't do?
I didn't do meetings and follow up and steps and all that other stuff. It didn't really introduce, suggested to go to meetings, but it, they didn't take you outside.
You can get pretty far on structure and discipline, but not all the way as doing the work, right? And I think that that works for a lot of people for a while. You can go to the gym and you can get 9 months on the gym, don't you think? We see it all the time with the guys that come to the meetings.
Gym, I mean, we got one now that he could stay sober just by, you know, doing steroids and going to the gym.
Like, right, hey,
good,
exactly.
Good for you, dude. That's for, but every time he comes back and he's all fucked up.
Right.
You know, and it's like, hey, we're going to do something different this time. And then he'll do it. He'll jump into it for first couple steps. And after 2-3 months, he's out. And I get it. I've done it.
I get it too.
I've done it. Like I say all the time when I share, like I've done 95% of this, that other 5% that I didn't do that almost fucking killed me.
Yeah. I see that even with Skylar right now. Skylar, actually, he did all 12 steps this time. And he had done this when I met him. He had completed the 12 steps. He was sponsoring. He had a sponsor, all the things. And then he never did it again after we got married until this time. And he could get pretty far on doing well at work and being very disciplined physically. You know, he works out a lot. He would get pretty far this time. Again, all 12 steps, raising his hand to sponsor.
Right.
He comes down here and does a 10th step every night by himself, meditates. He's going to church on Sundays sometimes. Hey, if he can't make it, he watches it on his phone. Hey. I came downstairs this morning. I was like, it's like gospel music. But no, I'm thrilled. There's like a husband workshop at the church that he goes to. I'm like, oh my God.
I'm just saying, if I woke up Sunday morning and there was gospel music in my house, I would freak the fuck out.
I did. I was like, what are you doing? But it's great. But he's doing all the things, and he didn't for a very, very, very long time. You know, he's got a commitment on Sundays at HA. So anyways, so where did you go after you left that rehab? Did you go back to the house? So did you guys still own that house?
I have a disease of rationalization and manipulation, you know, and so do you. Most of us do, and it lives inside of us. It's not always the external factors. It's the internal factors.
Yeah.
So, and it manifests in a couple ways. And for me, and we could talk about the other ways, in that particular time, I was under such high supervision and accountability that the second somebody's not looking, my disease says, if you don't get high now, you'll never get high again. And, you know, it'll just, so it just kind of, as soon as somebody's not looking, whether I plan to or not, that disease just acts up. And then it's also, hey, you deserve this.
Right.
You know, it lies to me in a lot of different ways. It's like, hey, you deserve it. It's like, hey, I just did 10 months in this place. I'm doing great. I can get high just one time.
Totally.
Other people get high. I can get high just one time. And that fucking first step, dude, like, you know, for me, after going through like so many times, I love kids that went through treatment a million times. Because it's so easy, dude. They fucking hate me, dude. If they sit down, it's like, all right, dude, we're going to do your first step. We're powerless. I'm manageable. Blah, 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 blah. I'll read this. And it's like, all right, dude, how about this? You've been to treatment 7 times. Write down those 7 experiences to me. And we'll talk about if you're powerless and unmanageable.
I like that.
You know what I mean? Because you left treatment saying you were going to stay sober.
Yeah.
And somewhere between here and 6 months from here, something fucking happened where you picked up once. And you couldn't fucking stop.
Yeah. It's a great technique for someone that's been to treatment a ton, because that's what finally clicked for me too. So when you left, where did you actually physically go? Did you go back to your house?
When I left, I gave my graduation speech with a vial of ketamine in my pocket.
Oh, shit. So that was the first thing you used when you left was ketamine?
It didn't show up on urine.
Right. Okay. So were you using in the house at all or no?
No, not in the house. But when the day I left, and then within like 2 or 3 months, I needed another treatment facility.
Okay.
And then
where did you go that time? Do you remember?
I always went back to the house.
Okay.
There was always, my father always, you know, he did the best he could. And, you know, I started by saying like, hey, you know, I grew up in a great family experience. I have nobody to blame. I had every opportunity.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to really see that because my family still blames themselves.
Okay.
And I don't let them any fucking more, dude, because I made my own fucking choices. But my father would never let me be homeless or hungry.
Okay.
He thought I would die.
Okay.
Or that was just part of, he just didn't know. He didn't realize, like,
I understand that.
He didn't realize, like, hey, this kid needs to be fucking homeless and hungry. Like, this is what he needs. He needs, he didn't mean to quote unquote enable me. That wasn't his intention. He was just loving his son the best way he knew how.
Of course.
And protecting his son the best way he knew how.
Right.
You know, in hindsight, we might call that enabling, but that's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How we viewed it at the time.
So you would go bounce back and forth from being able to live at that home and the treatment center, and then you would kind of do well, use again, and go back. That was the pattern for how long, would you say?
Oh, man. It's both from that treatment center to when I actually got sober and had a clean date I could hold on to, 12 years.
Of going back and forth between those two things?
It wasn't this, like, the stints were always different. So sometimes I'd be out for 3 months, sometimes I'd be out for 4 or 5 years.
What would you do? Oh, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
What would you do life-wise during that time, work-wise and day-to-day?
Work with my family when I could.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Skiing, getting high, however I could.
Okay.
I mean, progressively deeper and deeper bottoms, but I just lived the life of an addict.
I mean, but you were able to live in that house.
But I think the question is, was I a functioning addict? And I was not.
Okay. So you were able to live there, even though you weren't very functional because of what you just said. Your dad said, you get to live here. It's okay. They were always just kind of trying to help you.
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of hustles did you have to come up with cash?
I steal a lot.
Okay. Like from stores or people?
People, stores, family, for sure. I would, if I had a decent enough plug and I could manage, you know, selling some shit for a while, I would do that.
I would try.
I always had a good name in the neighborhood. I really never many people.
Okay.
So I always had a good name in the neighborhood where, you know, once I find that golden dealer, the one that would give me the credit line I need.
The credit.
Yeah.
The front.
And then I
forgot about, you know, you forget a lot. And like, I watched something recently about like a TikTok. You know, you get a front for $20 and you got to pay him back the next day. It's such a key part of the process. But I forgot. I forgot about going to the guy and being like, hey, man, can I get a dub till tomorrow? I really appreciate it. And you never know if they're going to say yes. I like fucking forgot.
So for me, most of it wasn't like, at least certain periods, it wasn't just, you know, I need $80 a day to get high. At least towards the end, that's what it was. A bundle of dope was $80 a day. It was, I need $1,000 to pay the plug for the credit line I ran for the last three weeks.
That's what my ex was. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'd be under the gun to make that happen.
Okay.
You
know?
But if I was working, like literally every Friday I would get paid, I'd pay my plug. And by,
get the new one. Yeah, get the new stuff.
I pay my plug, and then by Saturday morning I'm running credit again.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the same thing, I'll pay you on Friday, dude.
What kind of hustles did you do store wise? Like, did you guys do? Because I don't know, New York. Like, it seems like it would be different out here, and in a lot of places you get like little things from Home Depot. Return them for the gift card.
Same
trade
thing.
The gift card.
Those,
same stuff.
Those are all national.
Okay,
they're national. National policies. Dude. Yeah.
But I would, for some reason, New York to me, New York scares me. Okay, I went there once, and it was super fun. But I walked through the city like this. I didn't want to touch anything. And it scares me. I don't think I could hang there, even though I lived in LA. It scares me. It's so loud.
Really?
Yeah.
It's there's a lot going on.
Right?
Sure. I go home every Father's Day as an amends.
Oh, you do?
Okay. And I go home on Christmas.
Okay.
And I've been doing that since I've been sober the last 7, 8 years. But I don't feel at home there anymore.
You don't? Okay.
No.
Okay.
No.
So when you eventually progress to heroin, when?
I don't know. I think I was maybe 32 or something like that.
Late, like me. Our stories are remarkably similar timeline-wise. I didn't get strung out till I was 31.
Really? No,
yeah.
I was...
I was fucked on coke. I didn't get strung out on heroin until 31 years old, dude.
So I didn't even really like the pills. So, I mean, I do coke, but I would do coke like other people did meth. Like for 5 days.
Yeah.
I had good coke.
Okay. I was going to say, I never found anything that good.
No.
That's why I did math.
I had good coke and I had a good credit line. And
okay.
The thing about coke is the quality of it goes down as it gets later at night. So like at 8, 9 o'clock at night, it's good. At like midnight, you're getting your last good shit. 2 in the morning, it's getting worse. By 5 in the morning, you're getting some terrible shit. And then I'll wait for my dealer to wake up again because I'm that guy. If I picked up coke and I had Xanax, it was the difference between it being a fun night or a weird fucking 6 days because I needed the Xanax to pass out. And if I didn't, I'd be going for 6 days. But I never got into like the opiates and stuff like that.
Okay.
I don't know. I really wasn't into like.
No, I'm the same way. I want to be awake and I want to be talking.
Well, so no, Vicodins and Percocet, they get me up and focused. Actually, you know, I get
in the beginning, for sure.
But I'm more in control than coke or meth.
Yeah.
When I'm on opiates, you know.
What was your physical state at this time? Were you skinny and falling apart and looking like shit? Because I can't picture you looking like shit, but I'm sure you did.
I mean, I'll show you a detox picture when. But yeah,
I want to see a detox picture.
I was pretty. I'd have to find it. We'd have to dig through it. I was pretty. I think I was about 40, 50 pounds lighter for sure.
Did you pick your face or anything?
No, not really.
I feel like not as many men do that. Skylar did. Skylar picked bad.
But I didn't have the weight on me, so I looked, you know, even younger.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? I'll find that detox. I looked fucking young, dude.
So when and why does it progress to heroin?
I think I was in New York and I had some friends that were starting to get into it because they had done the jump from pills to heroin thing. I just did heroin like once or twice. Never got into it really in New York. Once, twice, exposed to it, never got into it. Came out here because I wanted to get sober.
Oh.
It's the first time I wanted to get sober.
Okay.
How old were
you when you came here?
29.
To San Diego?
Orange County.
Okay. What brought you to Orange County?
So it was 29 when I started dope. But I came out here because I really, really wanted to get sober. I couldn't live the way I was living. And I made the phone call to my family and it's like, we've been waiting for this fucking phone call for the last 10 years. Thank fucking God. Like, you know what I mean? I was so nervous. Like,
did they send you to a treatment center out here?
Send me to a treatment center. This was, you know.
Which one?
14 years ago. It's no longer around.
Okay.
This was when everything was cash pay.
I know. I was going to say that's new that it's insurance pays for anything.
Yeah, exactly. And I went to that treatment facility and I did 95% of it. They said, go to sober living when you leave after 90 days. And I didn't want to. I had it. I didn't want to. I knew where the meetings were. I got everything I need. I'm going to do that. But anyway, I still was out of place here. And I said,
you fell out of place here.
Yeah, I said, I just need some Vicodin or some Percocet. I'm going to go up to Huntington Beach. Give me 10 of them. I'm going to go up to Huntington Beach. I'm going to pick up 4 or 5 girls, get their numbers. Once I have their numbers, I never have to pick it up again. Yeah. But I need to do this. Like, you know what I mean? And I went to somebody asking.
You wanted the Percocet to feel comfortable enough to talk to girls then you weren't going to get Percocet again. That was the plan.
When I was on opiates, dude, you couldn't shut me up. Dude.
Yeah.
Like it lifted all that fear and insecurity. And, you know, opiates allowed me to connect with other human beings. Like,
yeah.
In the absence of drugs and alcohol, you know, people say they drank and used to not feel anything. And for me, I drank and used to feel something.
Yeah.
Because in the absence of drugs and alcohol, I was fucking empty.
Yeah.
There was nothing there. It was just blank, dude. You know, just only things there were feelings of hopelessness, feelings of being trapped, feelings of not wanting to do this anymore, feelings of insecurity. But that was just normal. And it was just blank. It wasn't like I was stewing in it. This was my baseline. I mean, opiates allowed me to connect to other people. But long story short, I was asking for opiates around here. And, you know, there are people like, where'd you get drugs? It's like, you guys brought me to NA, bro.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Where am I not going to find drugs, dude? And they said, hey, we don't do that stuff. We only do that stuff out here when we're trying to get well. And they had introduced me to heroin. And,
and you had never heard the phrase get well before?
No. And it was, you know, it was tar, obviously. So I'd smoke it. And for me, I'm really good at finding drug dealers and saying, you live with me now.
Okay. So you're that guy. Cause that's helpful to be that guy.
Yeah. Because or somebody that like it's literally hustle.
So you had a place. And so people could stay with you.
I had a place. And you find that guy that's hungry enough to go out and hustle to get the drugs. I mean, I'd still pay for it, but I'd have to go take him to go re-up.
My ex
and
I always found guys like you and we would do all the work. If we could stay at your house and shoot up.
Yeah.
I get you.
Yeah. So I was that guy.
So you started smoking heroin.
Smoking in Orange County, dude. I drove in my whole life in New York. I never got locked up. And, you know, Orange County, like literally the first night in DUI, dude.
Really? Yeah. Right when I moved to San Diego, I got a DUI within a few months. Like, they're strict out here, I think.
Yeah, dude. And then
what'd you blow? Do you remember?
I was fucking high, dude. Alcohol. Ew.
I got an alcohol DUI. Isn't that weird? But I'll still tell anyone that will listen I'm not an alcoholic because it was a 0.09, which is low.
I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I mean, too. I don't like the way alcohol makes me feel, but when I drink alcoholically.
Okay. So you got a DUI on opiates? Were you swerving?
I had a pretty nice fucking Jaguar with New York plates on it.
Where are you getting your dad is helping you with a place and a car. Okay.
Yeah. I got my DUI and we were fighting that. And as we were fighting that, I got another DUI. Like,
oh my gosh.
Later.
On opiates also?
Yeah.
Wait, what gets you pulled over on opiates? Swerving?
I have no idea, dude. I swear to God, they were like, every time they would get me,
you just got lit up.
Every fucking time, yeah.
And then how do they know your eyes are pinned and they draw blood?
Well, and then there's always foil in the fucking car,
right.
dude.
Okay.
You know, because I always had that foil.
There's foil
but
everywhere.
It didn't matter. After the first one and I was in the system, they were taking me in and they were drawing blood.
Right.
Anyway.
Totally.
Like, you know what I mean? And I think that was the other thing. They would see the car and then they'd see the New York plate.
Totally.
And they'd be like, what's this f***er up to?
So did you drive here from New York in the car?
No, I had it shipped.
Okay.
And then
what happens when you get an opiate DUI? Is it the same thing where you lose your license and you got to go to school forever?
Yeah, so I would lose my license. I'd still drive. But, you know, I think after the second one, we're like, all right, we'll go back to treatment. We did a lot of treatment between like 30 and 32 or 33.
Okay.
I go back to treatment for a year to try to fight it. And then I would literally catch another one. Like,
wow.
You know, I'd be dragging, my lawyer would drag it out in court for like 2 years.
And you'd get another one.
And I'd get another one. He'd be like, bro.
Another DUI in particular?
Yeah.
How many did you get?
3 in like 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
He'd be like, bro, what the f-? You know, and this whole time I'd be in treatment or sober living, and then, but as soon as I would get out, it's not like I was really getting high in those places, but as soon as I would get out and, when I had 2, they finally negotiated it down. They're like, all right, he's got 2 in like a year and he's done all this and he's been in treatment for 2 years. And my lawyer's just bullshitting the judge and everything else. And they're like, look, this kid's a fucking trouble, but this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to fucking do. We're going to waive his time because he's supposed to do a year in jail. We're going to still hold his license restrictions. All this kid has to fucking do, all he has to do is go and check himself into jail for the weekend. Have him go up to jail, check himself in for the weekend. We'll fucking forget about this. We'll put this 2 years behind me. That's all I got to do. What do I do?
Not that.
I got to go to jail for the weekend. So I got high for fucking 3 days straight. Like, you know what I mean? I had my drug dealer living with me at the time. He had him drop me off up in Santa Ana to the jailhouse. I've got about 3 grams of dope and about 15 Xanax up my ass. You know what I mean? And I'm standing in line for fucking jail just to get this over with. Like, you know what I mean? And the cop comes up to me and he goes, excuse me, sir. Like, you can't be here like this. He's like, you have to leave.
Because you were like nodding out?
I was so fucked up. They wouldn't even let me in jail. And this is in spite of all the consequences, and it's like, you know, it's going to take a real true addict or alcoholic to know that in spite of the consequences, no matter whatever the fuck is in front of us, we still cannot stay sober one fucking day, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was the story of my life for, you know, 20 years, dude.
Would you have to detox when you would get arrested? How often were you kicking?
Oh, dude, a lot.
So you were strung out physically on heroin.
I did a lot of self detoxes, but
just
like,
at your house.
Yeah, okay. Which was they never lasted.
I don't know how anyone ever did that though. Skylar would do the same thing. He'll get like a week by himself. Like I would never. Would you get like a few days and be sick and try to find some Suboxone and stuff?
So
when Suboxone's new for this time.
Suboxone didn't work for me.
Really?
No.
Even if you waited 24 hours?
My symptoms aren't stomach and stuff like that. My symptoms are I can't sleep.
Yeah, me too.
Insomnia for
and Suboxone month. Wouldn't help.
No.
Okay.
No, Xanax helped, which is where I got a crippling Xanax habit from. I was getting like 250 Xanax. There's been times where I've taken like 7 bars and not been able to sleep.
So are you missing, because the people that I interview that have a lot of benzo history, are you missing like chunks of time from your timeline?
No, never blacked out.
Really? You remember stuff?
I was fine.
Okay.
Honestly, I probably have some generalized anxiety disorder. Like anytime I'd go to the doctor, they'd just be like, oh, hold up. Before you start, take this Xanax. Go calm down.
You seem anxious.
And come back, like, you know what I mean? Like,
God, people still say that to me.
Yeah, well, me too. But if I could take them responsibly, I'd probably be a good candidate for them on a daily basis. But
I don't think I've ever shared this on the show. Skylar and I were going to marriage counseling, right? When he was tanking our whole fucking life last year, we were going to counseling and he was supposed to be clean, but he wasn't. And I remember walking in and the counselor lady said to me, she was like, so. Because I don't know what he was saying. He was like, she's mad at me all the time or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I am, you know? And she was like, so I can feel your energy and his energy is, you know, here and yours is like here. And there's definitely a gap. And I'm like, yeah, because he's fucking super duper high and I'm super duper mad. And she was like, but your energy is like, it's like palpable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he's
then
the
it's
victim.
Actually,
he's the victim.
I know. She got hit to his shit pretty quick, actually. But anyways, so anxiety is still there and you're in and out living in Orange County. When do you move down to San Diego? Oh, wait, you never do really until recently.
After that third DUI, because, you know, they said do 2. and then go to jail, and I couldn't even do that. And then I cut a DUI like 4 days later.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah, so I went to my, you know, lawyer, and my lawyer was just like, dude, go. Just leave the fucking state. He's like, I can't anymore. He's like, give me a check and just go. My father came out here and he bailed me out for the umpteenth time. And I went back to New York.
How old are you at this time?
33 or 32, something like that. And I went back to New York, and I didn't get out of bed for like a month. I was so miserable and depressed. Anyway, but I get back to New York, and you know, I met up with my friend, and you know, like, let's get fucking high, dude. And out here, I had to smoke dope and everything else and chase a dragon. And we get to New York, and this is like my first real experience with China White.
Yeah.
And they give me, you know, get a bundle of dope, and I laid down a line for myself, and I sniffed that line. And granted, I'm 33 years old, huge track history of lower bottoms and failure. And as soon as I did that line, I was so excited. I was ready to call my father and say, hey, I know things have been weird for a while, but I finally discovered what I want to do with my life, because I had just, because I didn't have to chase it anymore. I was high for like 3 hours straight. Like I just I had arrived, dude. Like, you know,
okay,
what I mean?
Wow.
Totally different than,
I never did it. I never even saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just, it was different. And then, you know.
And when you say I found what I want to do for the rest of my life, it was China White heroin.
That's it, dude.
Okay.
That's it. And then, you know, another 3 years of that.
Holy shit. Living in that same house?
I don't even know. I was living in some, I still had a house, a place provided for me.
Okay. Okay. Different. I guess that's my actual question. It doesn't matter where, yeah, but had a place provided for you, trying to work or just hustle up money. What were you doing?
I couldn't. I think I started getting into some real estate at the time.
Okay.
Where I could make my own hours and do that stuff. And, but I wasn't, you know, I did a couple of small deals. I couldn't say it was, you know, wildly successful or anything.
What made you never shoot heroin? Why did you only ever sniff it? Because
I don't know.
Did anybody ever offer you should bang this? It's easier. And I mean, you said no, or it never really came up.
The people that were doing it were kind of doing it off to the side.
Yeah.
I didn't need to.
Okay.
I could still get enough. And
you
like,
never felt interested in bumping up to that.
I didn't have to. It was just, if I'm going to bump it up, I'm just going to lay down. So towards, there's 10 bags in a bundle. And towards the end, I would do 5 bags in one shot. That'll get you, like, you know what I mean, where you need to go.
Yeah.
I get amped. I get excited.
Well, I don't even think needles make you higher as someone that's done both. It's just a different method of use, and you kind of get used to the pull and everything, but I don't even know that I could say shooting it, although my listeners are, tell me if I'm wrong, guys, maybe it is more strong and I just don't remember, because I didn't smoke for that long before I moved on to shooting it, so maybe I just don't remember. But I wouldn't have ever shot it either. I had a boyfriend make me. You can't make someone shoot heroin, okay? But he was like, we need to do this because your smudgy fingerprints are going to get us arrested because you're leaving them all over hotel rooms.
Whatever.
I said, fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So you snort heroin for 3 years, and you mentioned before we started talking, I told you Vegas ran somebody over and then went back and got money. And you said you had something similar. What happened?
Oh, so I totaled probably about 8 or 9 cars.
Oh my gosh.
On my journey.
Okay.
And, I think I might've been like 23 or 24. It was before my even first treatment center. Dude, I would just total shit, bro. And, I don't know. I was driving home. It was like 3-4 in the morning. And I had a bottle of Bacardi underneath my seat. I had about 10 Xanax and maybe like 2 grams of Coke. And 10 Xanax in this pocket, 2 grams of Coke in this pocket. And I'm on the phone with my girlfriend at the time. That girl was a saint. Poor fucking girl had to deal with me at my worst thing. I'm glad she found somebody better. I'm better than him now, by the way. I mean, just better at the time, bitch. But I was driving home, and I'm on Flushing Avenue, and it like forks off to the left, and I go to like make that left, and there's like a hill, and I'm driving some old school like 1988 Mercedes, like S-Class, like those tank ones, like the ones that Saddam Hussein drives into buildings and shit. You can't break these things, dude. They don't break. Things break around them. They don't break. And I go to veer left, and some motorcycle comes zooming up the fucking hill. I had hit that motorcycle so hard that his girlfriend actually went through my windshield.
So there were 2 people on the bike?
Yeah.
And she went through your windshield?
And I get out. I'm like, what the fuck happened? And I had no sympathy. I had no care in the world. Just what the fuck happened? And one of the gangsters from my neighborhood was there. He's just on the corner like 3 in the morning. I'm like, dude, I need you to do me a favor. I was like, I need you to go in my car. There's a bottle of Bacardi underneath my seat. I need you to get that the fuck out of there. And he does it. He cleans up my shit and everything else. And I'm staring at these people, and, you know, cops and EMS start arriving. I'm like, oh my God, what happened? But I'm faking it just so I could pull shit out of my pocket.
Oh my gosh.
And throw on the floor. I should have probably done a lot of time for that.
Yeah. Were they okay ultimately?
The EMS shows up and they're like, it's about time somebody hit this guy.
Oh.
Taking my side because he had cut that EMS off earlier, driving crazy.
Oh shit.
And the cops never even breathalyzed me or anything.
Wow. You got to remember, too, this is
3 in the morning. If you're out, you should be breathalyzed in general.
But 2003, it was different then.
Yeah.
It was already not 1978 where you could do anything, but it was still, it ain't like it is now.
There was a girl stuck in my fucking windshield. Right, like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care what year it is.
What ended up happening with the girl and the guy?
I went home and played the victim like I often do. Actually, I went home and then an hour later, I went back to retrieve my drugs I threw on the floor.
Okay.
Because that was all that was important. And I played the victim a lot. Like, you know what I mean? There was a time, like I talk about it now, like none of it was my family's fault, but it was easy for me to blame other people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you want to talk about, well, fast forward, I didn't think much about that kid ever again. Until my coke dealer about 4 years later was like, oh my God, you did that? He's like, that kid lost his leg. He's like, that was you, right? It was like, you know.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So, I mean, the girlfriend lived, I mean, it is what it is. It's just, you know, I don't know why I didn't get locked up that night. Yeah. There's a lot of times when I share at meetings, I say it and I mean it. I shouldn't be here. If not, and I'm not going to talk about all my stuff, I should either be dead or fucking in jail, dude. Yeah. There's no way I should have survived.
Yeah.
Not the way I used. And I didn't want to live anymore because of those feelings of being trapped and hopeless. And I would go out and I would use recklessly and I'd wake the fuck up and I would be so pissed.
Yeah.
I would wake up and my friends wouldn't.
Yeah.
When I got into treatment this last time, my best friend had passed away.
So you're 3 years in New York.
A lot of self-detoxing, a lot of Vivitrol is going to save me.
Oh, you would get on Vivitrol.
I couldn't ask anybody for help because I'd seen so many people go through the program and do everything. And I always hung out with people that thought like me, that acted like me, that looked like me. And like, here's the thing, I'm a fucking asshole. So like 90 days later, I'm still doing asshole shit. But then there'd be these other kids that were just kind of not like me.
Yeah.
And were taking things a lot more serious. I'd come back to treatment and that's my house manager.
Yeah.
And then I'd come back again and that's my clinical director. Like, totally. You know what I mean? And like, we're both.
That is what starts to happen. And it's so embarrassing.
Yeah. And it's like, we're just progressing in different directions, dude. And you know, me, my progression was deeper bottoms, but I was okay with that because I found comfort in that because that's all I knew. So, you know, fast forward, you know, I was in New York and I couldn't ask for help and I didn't have insurance and I couldn't ask for help because I couldn't look my father in the eye and say, this time's going to be different because I didn't fucking believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, couldn't even lie to myself. Like, and they would have helped me because just 90 days of Kevin not dying on my sofa would have been dope.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? But I'd made some friends out here. You know, suicide's a part of my story. And
I didn't know that.
I didn't actually succeed.
Right.
I failed at that too.
I don't think I knew that though. I didn't know you attempted suicide.
I could. It wasn't dying that scared me anymore. It was living.
Me too.
Because obviously at this time I'm 36 years old. I'm not going to and die. So what's my fate to suffer like a junkie and an alcoholic for another 30 years? Right. I can't do another 30 years of this shit. Just, you know, and I used to do math in my head, like how much longer does my father have to live? Because I didn't want to have my father have to bury me. I have to bury my mother.
Yeah.
And I would say, well, you know, maybe he's got like this much more time. And then when he goes, I can finally check out. And I told my father this after I got sober. And he just laughed. He's like, you would have been suffering a while, son. I'm not going anywhere. Stubborn Guido. But Narcan came out and it's a lifesaver and it is. And that's where we handed out in meetings and I got it in my car. But Narcan scared me because it wasn't dying that scared me. It was being revived. It did.
Yeah.
So I had the only way I could possibly do this, but get a hotel. You know, I lived in a family place, but, you know, 300 miles away. Get enough heroin, enough fucking Xanax, and just be in a place where nobody would revive me. And I had a friend that I'd grown up with, you know, we progressed together, I've known each other. You know how we, like, we're tight with people in the rooms because we know what we've been through? Well, he's that kid that I grew up with, but we also tried to get sober for 10 years together. Yeah. So he would go to treatment. I would go to treatment. Like, how are we going to do this? We'd get high to talk about like,
to talk about how we're going to get sober. Yeah, I would do that too.
Yeah.
I like did that too.
You know, with trade Suboxone and everything else. And, you know, we never went to the same place.
I did that too.
You know, he'd come back and he'd be doing good for a little bit and I'd be doing good for a little bit and we'd go to meetings together and then one of us would fall off and we would always co-sign each other's shit. Like, hey, dude, you're just doing Xanax. That's cool. Like, don't worry about it. Like, I was doing another self-detox thing. And I got a text message and I was like on day two or three, I never made it to seven, like Skylar, but I just couldn't live like that anymore. And I get a text message from somebody saying, sorry to hear about your boy. It wasn't somebody that was sorry to hear about my boy. It was just some f***ing sucker that wanted to be the first to tell me. And you know those people. You know what I mean? I didn't grieve at all.
And it was him? It was your friend?
Yeah, I didn't grieve at all. I just looked up. I said, Mike, you stupid son of a bitch. I actually felt okay for him because I knew he was free.
Yeah.
I had this suicide plan in my head and I can't really tell you clearly what happened there. I can tell you it wasn't me. You know, as much as I might have different views on spiritual experiences and stuff, like this wasn't me. And I had a friend out here, she owned a treatment facility and she happened to call me and ask me some stupid question. And I haven't talked to her in like God knows how many years. And I start telling her about my suicide shit, which I never told anybody.
And you had a plan and you were telling her about your plan.
Yeah. Okay. And which I never told anybody, you know what I mean? And I don't even remember the conversation, but, you know, because I just don't remember it. But anyway, the next day I had a scholarship out here, you know, and I had to get like, you know, I had to call charity to get my own plane ticket and stuff like that. So she scholarships me and she's like,
to SCRC?
No, it's just PPR.
Okay.
She was like, look, I'm going to fucking Europe for 3 months. She talks like us. She's like, I need you out here because I'm going to slap you so fucking hard before I get on a complain. But she had helped me out and she got me out here.
To Orange County or San Diego?
Well, I was hoping to go back to Orange County, but at that time she just opened a facility in San Diego too. Okay. She didn't want me back in Orange County.
Yeah, fair. Okay.
Fair enough, yeah. And I get to detox and I would always got to detox and I'd always felt like the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders. And I didn't have that experience this time. You know, I just didn't know why I was getting a chance.
Okay.
When like some, you know, 18-year-old girl is going to go out and take something she thinks is Xanax and die.
Yeah.
You know, and why some kid with a football scholarship, you know, is going to go out and drink tonight and get into a drunk, you know, there's so many other people better suited for this than me. I've had my chances. Like, why am I getting another one?
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about them.
So like some weird survivor's guilt. At
total
36.
Total okay. Survivor's guilt. Okay. Total survivor's guilt, you know. And I had dropped to my knees and I prayed to something and had a little understanding of, but didn't understand. And that was probably my second and third step experience because I just gave up. That was my surrender. That was, you know what? I'm not fighting this anymore. Okay. I'm not fighting. I'm not saying it's going to fucking work. I don't know if it's going to fucking work.
Yeah.
But I'm not fighting this anymore. And that's the definition of surrender isn't loss or defeat. It's just to give up resistance. It's just to stop fucking fighting. You know what I mean? And I had started to not hang out with people. I hung out with staff. I hung out with people that had 90 days, if I had 30 days. And I didn't care about the guy that had 7 years or 10 years. How'd you get through the fucking weekend, bro?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? That's what was important to me. And I just started doing everything that was, you know, put in front of me, dude.
How long were you at that program?
That detox, I was there for, you know, like 7 days or whatever.
And then you went to a treatment after that?
I went to treatment after that. That's when my detox actually began.
Right.
Because.
And then you get off the subs.
Well, it wasn't even the subs. I told you the subs don't help.
Oh, right.
I can't sleep.
Right. Okay.
And it takes me legitimately 30 to 45 days to sleep.
Oh, my
And
gosh.
I mean, like, I'll get like 2 or 3 hours every 4 days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, literally. And they would send me to a nurse and they'd give me trazodone and I'd be like, okay, la di da di da. And I'd skip back to my room and I'd go a whole week and I'd be like, okay, so still haven't slept, bitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, but they'd think I'm drug seeking.
Right.
And I'm just trying to be like the good client. Okay.
Right.
And then finally got to 30 days and I lost my shit. I'm like, look, I'm fucking seeing shit, dude. Like, you know what I mean? I haven't, like, I have not fucking slept in 30 days. I was more of a patient than a client my first 30 days. I should have been in a paper robe.
What program was this? Is it someone I know?
PPR.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, and started doing the step work. And
that's your sober date? That's it?
Yeah.
You never use again. So what's your actual sobriety date?
2/22/17.
Okay. Wow. So how long before you move out into a place? You finished treatment. How long was treatment?
I stayed. I wasn't going anywhere.
I guess that's what I want to talk about now. What's different now? You actually start doing the things. You're doing the steps. What's different?
a couple things. Like I said, I hung out with people that were doing it. I started doing the steps. I started getting involved. I'm not going to say I announced myself as a newcomer and this and that and got involved, like, you know, but I stayed and I stacked chairs. I did like whatever. Okay. Like I wasn't in the center of the pack. I was too insecure to be in the center of the pack. Yeah. I just kind of played, but I did everything and I listened. And
Did you start going to HA at that time or AA?
I did Tuesday. I used to go to Tuesday.
HA. And I was around.
Yeah. Here's one of the things that really changed. I didn't let my family help me. They weren't going to help me, and I didn't let my family help me. I did everything on my own.
Really? You got your car, yourself, rent, everything?
Everything.
Okay. Where did you start working?
I had started working at Ruby's on the Pier.
Okay.
Wearing a paper hat and a bow tie.
Okay.
And
you had been a cute server.
Yeah.
Like a server?
I wasn't even a server. They stuck me in the kitchen. Like, okay. I was a busboy.
Okay.
I fucking came in and I told my, you know, this is why I laugh at my smutsies and people are like, hey, I'm doing this get well job. I'm like, dude, like zoom out. Like this is just what you're doing now. But I did. I thought it was the end of the world for me. I mean, this is what I'm going to be doing the rest of my fucking life. Like, you know what I mean? And I told my counselor. And
Where were you living?
I lived in sober living. I lived in treatment. I stayed in treatment for a year.
Okay.
But I'm not going to say that's what did it because I've stayed in treatment for a year before.
Right. How were you getting to Ruby's?
I saved up money to buy a bike from the pawn shop.
Okay.
And I rode that bike to meetings, to work. I never got in the van again because I didn't want to hear their shitty music.
Yeah. Did I know you yet? I don't remember. We must have met.
Yeah. Well, Tuesday, probably.
Yeah.
I would come to Friday every now and then.
Okay.
Remember, I didn't have a car.
Okay.
So I was riding my bike.
Right,
but I would get down there every now and then. And
okay.
I had always, you know, this time I didn't have any help. So I busted my ass and I'm really glad. I'm so grateful for that because that's what saved my life.
Okay.
Because a couple things, you know, through the step work, I learned to not be a victim.
Okay.
Which thank fucking God.
What part of the steps helped you get there and what was the realization?
Really quickly, like steps 2 and 3 were the surrender moment. Like, you know what I mean? Step 1, I've been to treatment a million fucking times.
You understood you had a real problem.
Yeah. Like I knew that before I even got to treatment the first time. Step 4 was, it's so hard for people in their first year and really hard for me. Because as soon as you get sober, you start remembering shit you did.
Yeah.
And the shit you used to forget about. Like, hey, man, you weren't there for your mother on her deathbed. Like, remember that? You were in the parking lot getting high. All she needed was you to hold her hand. Like,
is that true?
That is true. You know, you weren't there for this. You weren't there for, you know, and heart disease manifested so many ways. So like it could be like, hey, the no supervision, like no accountability. Somebody's not looking right now. Or the other thing my disease would do is, you know, it would like a toxic ex-girlfriend. Like you have these toxic relationships and you finally get free of them. And then like all of a sudden you just start remembering the good sex. You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, but that was good. Yeah, the rest of your life was miserable. Yeah. Like every day of your life was miserable. But yeah, you're right. You had good sex one time. That fucking good for you, dickhead. And then, you know, that same girl would lie to me. Hey, it's going to be different.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? It's going to be different. And that's how my disease would lie to me.
Okay.
It's going to be different. Just let him back in. And then you let him back in and it's not different. Becky's still a fucking whore. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not different. It's worse. And that's the same with my disease. And it's a toxic relationship, very abusive relationship with my disease. And
that's interesting. Like, your disease is like a toxic ex.
Yeah.
Okay. And, like an abusive toxic ex. I've never heard that. I like that.
And it'll lie to you. And it does. You know what I mean? And then the other way my disease would play guilt and shame on me is, well, the other guilt and shame is what my disease used to do. And say, hey, you're not good enough for this. This is what you do. Hey, I'm glad you made your bed this morning in sober living, dickhead. You know what
at
I mean?
At 37.
Oh, yeah, exactly. At 37, too. I'm glad you went to group today. Like, you did your fucking chore. But by the way, you're a fucking piece of shit.
You're a loser.
This is what you do. You know what I mean? And I was really quick at identifying that stuff right away and saying, hey, I have a sponsor. And case manager, I have a million things, like those things that would keep me up at night, you know, things that, you know, just pop into my head when I'm trying to sleep. And I'd write all that shit down.
Okay. Like the things that would make you feel bad, you would write them down.
I'd write them down. And you know what? I see you, but I'm not dealing with you now because I'm not in a place to deal with you now. And I wouldn't hold on to it and I wouldn't stew on it. And I'd write it down.
Okay.
And then I did my fifth step. Now, my sponsor does, he looks like Jesus. Like, you know what I mean?
Do I know who's your sponsor?
Well, it's a different sponsor at the time. But, you know, anyway, I do my fifth step with this guy. And he's like, oh, good for you. Hallelujah. I'm so proud of you. We're going to burn it and, you know, go home and pray on it. And we'll turn it over to God. And you know, anybody that's heard me lead a meeting, I lost it. I was like, you fucking piece of shit, dude. You made me write all this shit down and tell you all this shit. Who the fuck are you? You want me to turn it over to some god? Who the fuck are you? This is me, homie. This is what I do. This is what I've done the last 20 years. You don't fucking know me. This is fucking me. You know what I mean?
After you said it all?
Yeah.
You had that reaction?
Yeah, I lost it. I lost it. You know what I mean? Granted, we weren't at 6 and 7 yet, and I went home really fucking mad.
What was his response?
He's like, yeah, just, you know, we're going to do 6 and 7 and this and that, but I need you to pray out. I understand, you know.
What were you upset about?
The whole, like, now we're just going to move on part.
Okay.
Like, you know what I mean? Just pray on it. Like,
okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay, okay.
Like, fucking home party doesn't got a fucking leg, dude. And that's just one story. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you think he wants me to go home and pray about it? Fuck you, dude.
Okay.
And I went home and I was so pissed. And you talk about a miracle. A miracle doesn't have to be a burning bush or anything else. A miracle is just a shift in perspective. And we could see things the way we've never seen it before. Yeah. At that night, there was a miracle in me where I looked at that stuff. And 95% of that stuff I did when I was drinking and using.
Yeah.
I did when I was living fix to fix. Like, you know what I mean? That wasn't me. That was the addiction. You know what I mean? I don't have to hate me. I have to hate the addiction. You know what I mean? I'm not saying I don't have to take responsibility for being a loser for 20 years. Like, I can't hold a job. I can't do this. I can't do that. Like, you know what I mean? I have to take responsibility for having a disease. And my responsibility is, to separate myself from the disease. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But also to acknowledge I have a disease and to treat it. Now, granted, there's that other 5%. Like, you're still a douchebag. I'm still a fucking douchebag. And we can work on that or whatever. We pray on it. you can pray on it. But that other 95%, I was able to forgive myself for. And that's something I'd never had. And by forgiving myself for that 95% of that stuff, when that guilt and shame would come up and that disease would try to lie to me and say, hey, you're not good enough, I'd say, you know what? I went to my meeting today. I'm doing everything I could do today to treat that fucking disease. And because of that, I was able to forgive myself. But most importantly, I was able to let my past stop defining me and break those cycles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, you know, once I let my past stop defining me, it opened up all these new doors, dude. Like, you know, I mean, I'm a pretty successful fucking realtor, dude. Like, you know what I mean? I'm great with money. Like,
yeah.
I don't just, like, I couldn't hold a job. I don't just adult. I adult on a higher fucking level, too. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I can do, but I never thought I was capable of any of that stuff. And I wouldn't have been if I let my past keep defining me.
Wow. I love that.
So.
Wow. Okay. Damn.
That was, and I share that a lot.
I love that the miracle is a shift in perspective.
Yeah,
that was true for me too when I saw it as the best thing that ever happened to me versus something to be really embarrassed about. That's like a literal miracle that shifted my perspective.
Right.
So you have that perspective, and then where do we go from there? How do we get to the guy right here?
Well, we continue one day at a time, putting in the work, little incremental steps. I'm really good at like goal setting and stuff like that, which I wouldn't have known.
How? What's your process?
If I set goals,
you write them down and timeline it. What do you do?
Small, measurable, like timeline type goals, you know.
What is it? Small, measurable, actionable, realistic, timely?
Something like that. Smart goals,
yeah.
Hey, like we were talking about it earlier. People say that because you're an addict, you're less equipped for life. No, I'm not, dude. Like, you know what I mean? I get shit done.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
It's true.
I will find a way to get fucking high. So if my goal was getting high, I didn't stop from not getting high. So if my goal is to buy a house, like I'm going to buy a fucking house, dude.
Totally.
Like that's going to happen. Like if my goal is to take the next step in my career, like that's what's going to fucking happen. Plus the other thing with us is we see through bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like we're really good at that. And, yeah, there's so many things in me because of those tendencies make me better equipped for stuff like you. Like, what do you think, like, in your addiction makes you, like, as the addict in you makes you better equipped for real life?
I mean, like you said, everything. The hustle, right?
Right.
The hustle. But I think it's important, too, to actually go back and identify those moments for yourself, because it's one thing for you and me to say that, and we're good speakers, and it sounds good and whatever, but, like, to actually take that in, the person listening to, like, I had to, Rachel is like, I can't believe I said this, but Rachel, I was supposed to do my 4-step with her, and I didn't have a car yet, and she wasn't going to come get me. I was in Vista, and she was in Oceanside, and I really wanted to get it done, because I was fucking terrified this time, you know, and I had, like, 6 months, which I'd never had. And I remembered taking the Sprinter, which is the train here, to go get dope. I took the Sprinter, like, I don't know, 30 minutes to pick up, do it, get back on. And I thought, if you can take the Sprinter to go get dope. You can take the Sprinter to go do your right. four step. And I actually took like an example of me using something in my addiction that was difficult and leveraged that memory into doing something in the present that was difficult and stuff like that. Like when the studio closed, Skylar and I didn't miss a beat. Like a lot of other owners stopped and paused and thought about what was going on. We didn't do any of that. He threw up that fucking tent outside. We didn't apply for permits. We didn't do any right. of that. And I think that
just
that's like the dope fiend in us.
Yeah, you just got it
yeah.
done.
And I'm also on another level too. I'm a much better teacher now too than I was as an instructor because I was always like a decent instructor. I had a good ear for music and I can speak well and whatever, but I was missing an element of that deep, extreme gratitude and value for life. And I know it sounds cliche, but it's true. I'm so happy to be there, dude. What? I thought I was never going to teach again. And that's a direct result of my addiction and sitting in not tents, but sitting in a bush thinking I would never teach spin again. And now I'm there. Right. And that gave me an extra level as well.
Well, it also allowed you to connect with your clients on a yes. different level.
100%. That too, you know,
we put up those shields when we're using, we put up those shields. We need them to predict.
Yeah. And survival. I didn't even have access to that side of me when I was using, even when I was just doing coke and teaching, like I didn't even have that like available when I was teaching. And I was a mask of being cool. I wanted to be really cool. And now I'm pretty authentically who I am all the time. I'm not really worried about what I look like to others. I mean, I am for sure. Like, I don't want somebody to talk shit to me on Instagram or something, but like, I don't act different now in the moment. I would calculate my responses for years. What do I think this person wants me to right. say and do? And I don't do that anymore. And I'm sure I did that while I was teaching too. What?
I'm just thinking
about, I thought you saw
I'm just thinking about being all coked up, having these conversations in our head.
Dude, yes. I would be high on coke doing the Buddhism mantra, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, that like Buddhist mantra on coke to get myself sober. Thinking I would be on coke planning like my 1 year token speech.
I've done that.
Yeah.
I've done that.
Years before I got it. I remember being in 2008 in Venice.
It's going to be a lot of look at me and fuck you.
Of course. Yeah. I remember doing it in the shower in Venice where I lived and I didn't take a 1 year token until 2016, 8 years later. But so when did you move out of sober living and into your first place?
So I had started after that get well job, I started doing estate sales with some people and they were at the time, they were really good people and they gave me an opportunity and worked my way up to management and get well job. I thought it was a career, but once again, it's just another step. And, they had offered me a staff position. So I always had a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. And I still do. That's just how I am. So like, it was like, you know, they were going to open a new facility and they were going to offer me a staff position at this treatment. And that's what I wanted to do because that's where we see the most success.
You wanted to get into treatment.
Yeah. Okay. We see the most success with people that work in recovery. And the funding got pulled for it. And, my plan B was, I'll work with these guys and figure something out. And somebody had moved out of this guy's house and he offered me, he's like, dude, you can come live with us. At the time they had like 3, 4, or 5 years sober. You had to be sober to work there and everything else. And I think I had like 11 months or 10 months sober time. And I asked for advice. This was the difference. I asked for advice on everything I did.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And that was
from people in recovery.
From people. Yeah. Okay. I didn't just take my own will. And the director of that place, I went to his office. I love that guy. I really respect him. And I said, hey, look, here's the thing. I know that didn't work out, but this is like what's next for me. And he's like, what do you think? Do you think it's a good move? He's like, yeah. He's like, I think it's a good move. I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to do it. He goes, okay. He's one thing. He goes, what? He goes, when you came in here broken and shattered, you said you were going to stay a year. He's like, sober people keep their word. And you got 10 months or 10 and a half months. And that stuck with me. And I was like, you know what? You're right. So I actually paid rent there and still stayed in my sober living.
Oh.
To keep my word.
Wow.
Yeah. I bounce that off people all the time because it is.
I have heard you share now that you say it. Yeah. I've heard you say that before.
It is. It's integral. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When we commit to something, we got to stay committed to it. Life may throw us some curveballs. And I can't say that extra month in sober living changed my life.
That's not the point.
It was exactly. It was the point of just living with integrity.
Yes.
And then... but things shifted, throughout my journey. But when I got to step six, when I started doing, my fifth step and looking at everything else, I was really good at playing the victim.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I
asked you about, yeah.
And I blamed my father, poor me, poor this, poor that. It was never my father's fault. That man loved me the best way he knew how. And I put him to hell and back, or if my mother didn't die, or if this and that. And doing this, I was able to really take responsibility, which thank fucking God.
Yeah.
Because if I make a mistake, I can fix it. I cannot do that again. If somebody else fucking wrongs me, there's nothing I can do about
it. That's how I feel too. Taking responsibility for my addiction was very powerful. Right. It wasn't my ex's fault who made me shoot heroin.
Right.
Because if it's his fault, then only he can fix it. And he's on a warrant. He'll never return.
Right.
So yeah. I have to fix it.
Right. Everything.
Thank God.
Yeah.
It's up to me.
Now I'm empowered.
Yeah.
Not being a victim. It empowers me to can handle shit, you know.
Totally.
I mean, there's things that happen in people's lives, and you know, there are instances like where it's like, hey dude, you were the victim. But if you carry that around, your part.
Yeah,
that's your part in it, dude. You're letting it hold you hostage for the last 20 years.
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean, that's your part. You got to let it go. And
right.
And then the steps to 8 and 9, 6 and 7, I still work that shit like consistently as best I can, man.
By that you mean looking at character defects, are they showing up for me today? How do I address that? What do you mean by working them?
So I have a ton of character defects for sure, you know, and I'm dealing with some like business stuff that's they're jumping out a little bit. People can look at their character defects and say, hey, I'm being impatient. Let me find patience. You know what I mean? And a lot of people do it like that, and that can work. For me, if I'm doing a 6 and 7, and I haven't been doing it perfectly, so if anybody knows what I've been up to the last month, so take your own inventories. But, you know, I'd have to write down, well, Kevin's impatient, Kevin's judgmental, Kevin's greedy, Kevin's this, Kevin's da da da. You know what I mean? And this is the column that Kevin lives in. And what column does, what would God be in the other column? You know, well, God is not impatient. You know what I mean? God is definitely not judgmental. God is not angry. God is forgiving. For me, working a 6 and 7, you could try to have more of those characteristics. But for me, when I work 6 and 7, you know, I kind of do a third step prayer. I'm not trying to work 6 and 7 by adding other things. It's not like by adding.
Okay.
I believe the subtraction of Kevin is the existence of God. So wherever Kevin lives, God does not. When Kevin's living in this column, that's okay. Fucking Kevin. That's not God. And if I want to talk about a spiritual experience, I don't care if you have a fucking God or not. Like the fact that you have a conscience, everybody's born with a conscience. God lives within you.
Okay.
Whether what you worship, what you do on Sunday, like there's a piece of God in you. So when I do steps 6 and 7, I kind of do a third step prayer. God, I offer myself to you. So it's, you know, God, bring me to you. Let me understand you. Let me see you more, just so I can get myself, get this world, and relieve me of the bondage of Kevin. Relieve me of all these things that make fucking Kevin, dude. And if we can relieve me of that, then I can be somewhat more understanding of what you want for me.
Oh, I love that.
So it's more spirituality by subtraction.
Okay.
Not addition.
Okay.
You know, and that's one of the things I was kind of working on, but my latest sponsor, he's really big on spirituality by subtraction. You know, he's really big on, we don't even work on character defects. He's like, we just work on the fear.
Yeah.
He's like, because all these things stem from 2 or 3 fears.
Totally.
And what are those 2 or 3 fears? Let's address those.
I'm such a fucking fearful person.
Me too.
How does he have you address fears?
I really want to talk about this at a meeting one day. Fear, there's a couple of ways you can look at it. Your first year sober is so fucking scary, dude. Yeah. Because you got to make a bed, and that's terrifying. Yeah. Like, seriously, people don't get that, dude. Yeah. You got to go get a job, and we have to walk through a lot of fears. And I mean, we could look at it and say, what fears are rational and what's irrational? So the best way to tell it to like somebody like in their first year, it's like, hey, dude, you got to go to a job interview. He's like, yeah, it's scary. I'm like, what would happen? I don't get the job. Motherfucker, you've been unemployed for 4 years, dude. Like nothing changes, dude. Like you're afraid of not getting, you haven't had a fucking job. Oh, I want to talk to this girl and that's scary. Well, what happened, dude? Oh, she doesn't let me take her out. Dude, you've been jerking off at sober living the last 6 months. Like you could do it one more night. Like, you know what I mean? Like this. A lot of the things we fear, it's just, on the other, it's just completely irrational, dude. And the only thing we really should fear is staying in the same place.
Yeah.
Because that's more scary. Like, you know what I mean? But it's the, you know, it's the moving forward that's really terrifying to us. But people can talk about these fears and do all these workshops and this and that. Like for me, it's like, hey, we could talk about this. We can go through it this way and that way and everything else. The only thing that stands between you and freedom is fucking fear.
Yeah.
And the only thing to do is man up and walk through it. Yeah. I don't want to hear all this baby bullshit anymore. Grab your, put on your big girl pants, one step in front of each other and walk through it. And then you'll laugh on like how like ridiculous it was to let that keep you in the same place for 6 years. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
I love that. I agree with your sponsor. I think that's the main crux of like what so much of us, and probably non-addicts too, is, you know, fear controlling us.
Right.
You know? So working steps, you have your sponsor. When do you get to HA and start taking care of things during COVID?
I always kind of got a little involved. So I used to do a lot of refuge and getting involved in that level in refuge when I first got sober. So I did a lot of H&I for HA. I was a guy that used to do all the H&I and stuff like this. And we always had like a lot of facilities, like, you know, 4 or 5 up to 7 facilities. And then COVID happened and we needed it. You know what I mean? And COVID pissed me off so much.
I know, me too.
I had such a problem with God, you know.
I lost myself during that time.
Dude, so
I was so angry.
I had moved from Orange County back down to San Diego to finally start my real estate property management stuff. And I get here and they're like, hey, welcome to the company. You're laid off. You know what I mean? And then I lost like pretty much my life savings. And then, you know, dealing with a breakup at the time, which still hurt. And then I get a puppy and the puppy died like 3 days later.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So at this point, like this is, I was so angry, dude. I was so angry. And at that point, I had lost my relationship with God. So steps 2 through 12. Them, you know what I mean? And picking up sounds like a good idea. It's like, dude, get a Corona. You deserve a Corona. Fuck a Corona. We don't want Corona. Get some dope. Yeah, well, right, go get some dope. Can you do dope just one time? No. Like, you know what I mean? I knew that. So that's why I'm really big on the first step. Because if you have an experience like that, steps 2 through 12 don't work for you. That first step will save your life, and it saved mine. But anyway, I digress. We were doing a lot of H&I because we needed it. And I'm, you know, looking at all these numbers. I don't want to get all political, dude, but like not all these people died from COVID, dickheads. Like, you know what I mean? Like they were manipulating the numbers and it was election year and all that other stuff. I'll stop. But I had a real problem with the machine and how things were running. And meanwhile, you know, they're so worried about people dying from what is a flu. You know what I mean? I'm not saying people didn't die from it, but, you know, addicts are dying by the boatload.
Right.
We just took a bunch of like addicts, gave them $1,000 a week, took away their f-ing meetings and turned it like, all right, cool.
But dude, that's f-ing true, dude. Because I wasn't using them, but we got money.
Yeah. Yeah. People too. Like, if I was an addict, that's the biggest come up.
Totally.
And then there's no place to go for a solution.
Totally. Either, that would have been great.
So we were doing a lot of H&I and the community is such a big part of what we do.
Yeah.
And I don't believe Zoom is the place to do that.
Right.
Now, I've sponsored people that got sober during
that time.
During COVID.
For sure.
And I have the utmost respect for them because I don't know if I would have been able to do it. We really needed live meetings, dude.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, dude, we're just going to start doing live meetings. And I stopped doing H&I. It's like, you know what? We have live meetings now.
Yeah.
We're not going to do your H&I anymore. Drive the fucking van to the meeting.
Who did you even talk to get like the H&I? Who was running it at that? Bree? Bree.
Nobody. We just started a fucking meeting. I don't ask for permission, dude.
So where did you get the... Did you reach out to HA and get the readings and stuff and just start telling people we're having it? Because there's like a little bit of a process, right, to get it on the meeting schedules or no?
No.
Okay. Because I heard about it somehow that you were doing them in the park and stuff.
You go to HA World Services, you print up readings.
It's okay.
Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's not like, it's one of those things like people are like, how do I do this? And I'm like, you just f-ing do it.
Yeah.
Dude, life is about people that do shit. Like, you know what I mean? Don't ask. I even with district now, I don't really ask for permission to do stuff because they can hold it up and like, hey, well, we want to do it this way. We want to do it. And they'll talk about it for 6 months.
Right.
That's the place where dreams go to die because they just get over political about it. And it's like, no, if you want to do it, just do it. I have a kid that started a meeting in a Santee and, you know, I was starting a lot of meetings at the time and he heard me lead in PB and he's like, yo, how do I start a meeting? I'm like, you just do it.
Yeah.
He's like, what do you mean? It's that simple. I'm like, yeah, dude. I'm like, I'll send you some formats. You figure out what works for you. And the kid, in his first year sober, I think at about 6 months sober, started a meeting, dude. Aww. And that meeting's doing really well.
Because
this program is about people that do shit.
Yeah.
You know, service is a verb.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you can get caught up in the traditions and the politics and all that other stuff. But a lot of those people that really get caught up on the traditions and stuff like that are the same people that have never done a goddamn thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have a kind of resentment for those people too, because those are the people that they're not doing stuff and they won't let anybody else do anything.
Yeah. Well, you do more service than just about anybody else I know.
Thank you.
Honestly. And I was so grateful. Somehow I heard about the park meetings and started going, and I knew you. I had to have known you. I remember walking up and saying, hey, Kevin.
So I had just moved back, well, during that COVID thing, but Step House just opened up and it was outside. They were letting people do meetings outside, but they were only letting like 30 people in.
Okay.
And so many people needed meetings, like 60, 70, 80 people would show up.
Right.
So, Bryce actually said, hey, I'm going to do an AA meeting across the street.
Okay.
And I was like, cool, you do your AA meeting. We're going to do an HA meeting on Saturday. And Emily actually helped
get
that started because Emily was around at that time. And then, you know, we were able to get a few more meetings started in the next couple of years. A lot of people during COVID, I don't care what fellowship you're from, they stopped going to meetings and they never came back.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one thing if you're AA and you got tens of thousands of people and there's a lot of people with gap, you know, can kind of fill that gap.
Yeah.
But with HA,
I know.
It was dead.
I know.
There was nobody came back, dude. And it's like,
we finally did.
I know, but a lot of people either went out,
yeah,
or a lot of people went to other fellowships, or a lot of people, you know,
just didn't come back.
They just didn't come. So it took a long time for HA to establish a core group. Like right now, Saturday's got like
it's so good.
Yeah, it's got like
so good.
Good.
It's such a good meeting.
Yeah, dude. And they handle shit and they like getting shit done. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's do an event. I'll throw an idea out there. They'll just run with it. And I'm like, okay,
cool. It's so cool to watch.
Yeah. Same with Friday. Friday's doing really.
Is it? Okay, good.
Really,
I'm just, I can't believe that was my home group for so long at 9 p.m. at night. I can't do it anymore, dude.
It's not my favorite.
I'm like, no way.
I like the meeting, but I do work on Saturdays sometimes.
Yeah, I do try to teach in the mornings.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did that 9 p.m. Meeting for years where I met Skylar and I would teach the next morning at 8 a.m. And now I'm like,
dude, we're
drinking coffee in the parking lot, like before I go in. Like, this is horrible.
This is how old and sober we are.
I know.
And I was explaining, somebody's like, I can't believe you do it at 9 p.m. I'm like, hey, dude, like, we're tweakers. Generally, we come out after the alcoholics go to bed. So like 9 p.m. is where we, that's just kind of par for the course for each
other. I can't anymore, though, man. I can't. So anyways, what does your life look like today? What do you got going on?
I have a really good life. Like I said, I got a pretty good career, dude. I've taken a lot of major leaps in the last year. The only thing standing between me and that is, was fear.
Okay. Like,
you know what I mean? So even now, point is, even now, I'm still walking through fear as far as taking my next step. And I think when we talk about that fear, fear is a good indication of where we next need to grow.
You think?
Yeah.
That where you're afraid is the right direction?
Well, I think if you're afraid of something, what are you afraid of? And then we got to walk through that bitch.
Okay.
No matter what it is. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm saying, I think it'll be like an indication of where's my next step throughout my life.
Right.
You know what I mean? 7 years sober, 8 years sober, you know, 20 years sober. I think there'll always be the next step. But like you said, it's a lot of service. I have an amazing girlfriend that's totally the opposite of me. And thank God, because two of us, like, you know what I mean?
Imagine?
Like, it's like Skylar being
we're like
opposite.
The exact same. Yeah. You and I are like the exact
same.
Yeah,
it's like, that's why like Skylar and Amy are a totally different energy level.
I know.
Totally laid back. And
thank God though. Can you imagine? Like he has to be him letting me be me, which not a lot of guys would be want.
Yeah.
I'm loud.
Yeah. No. And that's same with Amy, dude. She lets me just kind of run.
Yeah. She just lets you go.
She lets me run my shit, dude.
And she thinks you're funny and she thinks it's cute. Obviously when you say like outlandish shit, she's laughing. How did you meet her?
Saturday meeting.
Oh, you did? Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, she started getting really involved. But yeah, she lets me just kind of do her thing. She never judgmental word or never anything. I've been with her 3.5 years. I've never had a fight with her.
Really?
I've never had a fight with her.
Wow.
There's been times I've been upset, you know, and I hang up the phone, like, call your sponsor, click. Like, don't tell me to call my sponsor, bitch.
She's told you to call your sponsor?
Yeah. Oh, you know what? She said like a couple weeks ago, I do a lot of stock trading and stuff like that. And I'd lost a sizable amount of money like really quickly. She said to me, oh well, you know, she's such a hippie, dude. She's like, you know, Kevin, money comes and money goes. I lost my shit. Like,
where does money come
from? I lost it.
From what location?
I hung up the phone on her. I had to call her 2 days later. And I'm like, you know, this is why I'm upset. I'm like, you don't, money doesn't just come and go. I sit at my laptop. I go to work. I come home. I do homework. I sit at my laptop staring at stock screens for 4 hours of day, dude. It doesn't come and go, dude. I lost it, dude.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it went, but it didn't just come. It's not like somebody filled up my fucking bank account.
Right.
Like,
well, that is why she's great for you then. You know?
Yeah, I guess so. She's totally opposite when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. So what's next for you real estate wise?
They changed a lot of regulations as far as sales in the last year.
Okay.
So the industry is going to be changing a lot. As far as how commissions are paid out for buyer's agents.
Okay.
And we're going to have to see how that affects the industry. So like right now I had a couple really good, you know, buyer's leads, which is good because buyers need representation and all that. I'm not going to get into all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we're going to see how it goes. There was a class action suit that's going to change commissions on a federal level.
Oh, okay.
And we'll have to see. That's going to take effect in July. And right now I have some buyers I'm working with and some other things I'm doing. And I've just kind of had the conversation with them, briefing them for that. And what to expect. And we're going to have to see how the industry adapts. They've been doing this 40, 50 years, but I do a lot of property management, which is, and a lot of vacation rentals and stuff like that too. So I stay busy regardless.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, we'll see what happens in the next year or so, but it's not, normally stuff like that would cause a lot of anxiety, but for me, it's like, hey, let's just sit back and see how it goes. I have so much going on. When I got into doing real estate, I never wanted to work just on commission.
Right.
Just because I'm an addict.
Yeah.
And I didn't want the instability.
That's scary.
Yeah. So if I do home sales or stuff, that's extra.
Yeah.
And I'm good with money. So that goes towards extra.
And the property management is full time.
Yeah. That's how I pay my bills and everything else. And I can depend on that. And I'm really good at budgets and staying in budgets. Hey, this is what we do. This is what we can spend. That doesn't.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay. Last question. How's everything with your dad and your brother now?
We talk about amends 8 and 9. And for me, I tried to get sober so many times that I couldn't call people at 90 days and say, hey, guess what? Sorry. Sorry, I ruined the last 20 years of your life. And I'm really with people like me that have been through treatment a million times. I don't suggest that they do that either. I think with amends, it's selfish to impose on when those should happen.
Yeah.
Just because I'm 30 days sober, 90 days sober, 6 months sober, I got to make my amends. Hey,
so that I feel better.
Exactly. You caused 20 years of damage. They don't got to be fucking ready because you've hit a step.
Absolutely.
Like, you know what I mean? And I was really good with being patient on that. And I think the first time I went home to see my father, he was driving me to the airport and he's like, dude, he's like, you really don't drink? You really don't do anything? And he started to see that it was real. The second time I went home, you know, I'd asked him, I said, yo, where's all my clothes and stuff? Because, you know, I lived in a family property. He's like, oh, I put it in a closet. And I went upstairs to go see the clothes. And they were all stuffed in black garbage bags, crinkled up and thrown in there. And I didn't get angry or anything. Actually, I said, oh, man, dude, like the emotions this guy must have been going through when he was packing up my shit to just fucking throw it in a garbage bag. Like how frustrated and hurt and powerless and everything. And I pulled out two suits and I was like, hey, Dad, do me a favor. We're going to the airport, but can you get these dry cleaned for me? I'm done. Just do me a favor. Just get these dry cleaned for me. He said, what do you want the suits for, bro? He's like, you're afraid if I die, you're not going to have something to wear to the funeral? Which was true. Yeah, but it was true. And I said, dude, you die? Like, I'm not coming to your fucking funeral, dude. Like, you know what I mean? just hope that there's money left. Like, you know what I mean? He laughed and he's like, you know what? He's like, I can die tomorrow and be okay. He's like, I'm with how you are, how proud I am of you. And anywhere my father goes, like, that's what he talks about, how proud he is of me. And look, dude, like I said, I shouldn't be alive. And, you know, I was having a conversation with the sponsee last night when we were talking about acceptance and he goes, you know, absolutely nothing. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I have a real problem with that statement. But, you know, I really feel like one of the reasons I'm alive is so that I can be of service.
Yeah.
Whether I like it or not, sometimes it gets to be a lot. Sometimes it gets to be overwhelmed. But I was fucking spared.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And somebody was here for me.
Yeah.
When I came in and I have a responsibility to kind of be there for somebody else. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If not anything else, like, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this was fucking awesome.
Thank you for having me.
I knew I would love chatting with you about all this stuff.
Well, I'm glad you had me. It was actually a lot more comfortable than I thought it was going
to be. It's cool, right? It's not like, feels very nerve-wracking and whatever, but like after a little while, you kind of settle in too.
Well, you got a picture of Skylar over there.
Yeah.
That's a calming presence for me.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is he? No way. Really?
Skylar's very,
he is very calm.
Calming presence for me.
That's true. He is very calm. And I got the salt lamp too, that's supposed to be good vibes. I don't know. There's two crystals here. I forget what they are.
Ask Amy. She'll fucking tell you.
Right? She would know, huh? I don't even remember what the fuck they are.
She would definitely
I was trying to be like a crystal girl for a little while.
How'd that work out for you?
I don't know what they mean, so not very well.
You were a crystal girl for long enough, dude. The only crystals I know you could smoke.
Exactly.
And that's where it's
You're stuck. Right. That's, I shot enough crystal, but I was trying to be like a, you know what I mean? I went and bought these at a place. I don't know. I think one of them's amethyst. It's supposed to be for love. So anyways, that's a wrap. Thank you so much. That was fucking awesome.
Thank you for having me. And I love you and I appreciate everything you do, buddy.
I love you too, man.